Hello, and thanks for joining us on this episode of The Denfolks Way. We're a podcast developed and produced at the Defense Information School. This program is dedicated to developing and showcasing the skills of military communicators and public affairs professionals. I'm your host, Jack Rouse. I'm a former Navy journalist and a current training instructor here at Denfolks. On the show today is Colonel Dave Butler. He's a longtime communicator and public affairs officer, and he's currently the strategic advisor for communications and outreach for the Chief of Staff of the Army. He's been the PAO for the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Joint Special Operations Command, and has done everything from being boots on the ground in Iraq to forming information strategy for the entire military. In this episode, we'll talk about communication strategy and information warfare, the role of the modern public affairs officer, and some best practices for anyone seeking to communicate effectively. You know, I just listened to a conversation that you had with our public affairs officers here at Denfolks, and it was full of some really great tips and tricks. You've led a real storied career so far.
Thanks. Yeah, it was fun talking to the students. Try to get out here every class.
Just for anyone who wasn't here to participate in that conversation, can you give us first just a quick synopsis of who you are and how you got here?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a public affairs officer, have been for, I don't know, 10, 12 years, I guess. I was an infantryman growing up. And about halfway through my career, as the Army does, we switch over to public affairs. Luckily, had just the benefit of some amazing experiences through our time. I've been a public affairs officer on a ship sailing across the Atlantic. I've been on major national level operations and at some pretty cool points in history. And I'm just really fortunate to have experienced that. My last job before this was working for the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley, and now I work for the Chief of Staff of the Army, General Randy George.
What is, and having done all that, I'm sure you'd know the answer to this more than anyone, what is the role of today's public affairs officer?
Yeah, so I think it gets broken down in kind of two things. It's, you know, you got to be an advisor, and you've also got to be a practitioner. And I think common probably to every single public affairs office. I think people would want to define it one or the other, but it's certainly not. In every job that I've had to do the public affairs, but also been a close advisor to the boss, whoever that is. Breaking it down those two categories, in very general terms, and we talked about it, like you said, with the students, my job is to communicate to the American people and the nations of the world and our adversaries, one, to make sure that we have the resources, authority, and operational support that we need to defend this country, but also to deter our adversaries.
And obviously, of those two, I think deterrence is probably one of the biggest ones to concentrate on as a public affairs officer.
It depends, right? It depends on what you're talking about and who you're talking to. It's certainly, I would say, maybe the most important, right? Because the resources, authorities, and support are generally there in this country. We're very lucky to have an abundance of resources. We have a lot of support from the American public and from Congress. And day to day, we have very good authority from the president and from the Congress. The one thing, though, that we should keep in mind is part of that resource is not only money, but also American sons and daughters. And we are hurting on recruiting. It's getting a little bit better this year, and nobody wants to say that just yet till the numbers come in. But we're hurting on recruiting pretty much across the services. And I think somewhere, probably in some regulation or whatever, it says that there's a firewall between recruiting and public affairs. But I see that as one of our jobs too. I'm not out in the recruiting stations, but certainly when I take my boss to the Daytona 500, that's part of a recruiting effort.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we talk a lot about from an operational level how important it is to concentrate on strategic communication, but I think at a very basic level, it's important to get American eyes on our product, whatever that is, and attending things like the Daytona 500 is, you know, just great for our audience, I think.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of patriots out in the Daytona 500. A lot of slaps on the back that we're getting, and then our response is usually, hey, we're hiring. So so come on board. One of the things that we're actually trying to do on the recruiting side is just tell the story of the soldiers. And I know that sounds kind of cheesy, but instead of talking so much about what we're doing abroad, and that, you know, that's important for the American people to understand what we're doing, especially as it comes to putting people's lives at risk and also taking life. But I don't think we tell our story well enough. We don't tell maybe the benefits of service and, you know, how you get to see the world and, you know, how we give so much responsibility to young people, how we trust them with some really, really important jobs. I think the military is different like that. And I don't think that story gets out so well, because I think, you know, I'm speculating here, but I think if you ask a typical American what they think of the military, they think of something about war or something about conflict.
Yep.
You know, that's not what we do on a regular basis.
100%. And that's essentially what we do our best to teach our students in the fundamental courses, how important it is to get out the story of your average service member, because we concentrate on people. That's what we care about, is people. And we think too often that soldiers just shoot guns and sailors just drive boats and airmen just fly planes. You know, there's definitely bigger stories out there.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I mean, shooting guns and flying planes and driving boats is part of it. And
it's cool.
Actually, yeah, super cool part of it. But you get to do that while just serving like a regular human being. We're not in conflict all the time. So it's something that we're trying to turn the corner on a little bit. I mentioned we're working with the NFL to move from salute to service to call to service. It's just just one word change, but
significant.
I think so. I mean, at a typical NFL game, instead of recognizing just the wounded warriors who are in the crowd, which is important, you know, they bring them on the field and everything, and I think they still want to do that. But we want to do like a mass reenlistment, and then recognize some service members who are just, you know, doing their day to day job and enjoying their time in the military, in the army. So we're trying to bridge that gap a little bit.
That's excellent. I love that focus. That's super helpful, not just for, you know, the mission, but also for our communicators to really drive that as a focus. What skills do you think make an effective communicator these days?
I think you need to be an expert in your task. And I'm going to wrestle with this a little bit, because I don't want anybody to be intimidated. I don't mean that I have to. I don't mean you have to have a PhD in public affairs. But I certainly think that no matter what organization you're in or what rank you are, you should be the expert in your task, right? So a great photographer is the best photographer, you know what I mean? Because they know how to use that camera. They know how to set up a shot. They know the importance of context and stepping back from just hitting the shutter. They understand the broader context of what we're trying to do with that picture. And we shouldn't allow ourselves to be set aside in that capacity, right? So you could say, like maybe a boss would say, well, that's just the photographer. You know, stand in the corner, we'll tell you when we want the picture. You want that photographer to be the absolute expert, and he's calling the shots. You know what? The best photographers I remember having would take charge of the situation, almost interrupt the meeting. Maybe he lets the meeting end, but as soon as the meeting ends, he's like, "Hey, sir," and with courtesy, "yeah, you need to sit over here. Hey, sir, we got to move these papers. Hey, sir, if you pick your chin up a little bit, and sir, if you look over in my direction," and he's directing 6 4-star generals or something. And, you know, it's a E6 from the Navy or something. That I think of the best guys that are capable of doing that. And it's expanding the role of what somebody might define as a photographer. It's applicable at every level, right? And at my level, I strive to be the absolute expert in what I do. And you know, I'm happy to take everybody else's opinion, but I'm the guy that knows what's going on in the media. I'm the guy that knows what's going on in the industry of the media. I'm the guy that understands what our strategic narrative is and what OSD is trying to say and what the NSC is trying to say and the broader context of things. That doesn't come with, you know, 60-something days at DINFOS. You got to work on that. So I forgot what your question was.
No, you answered it perfectly. What skills should today's communicators have? Right. And I think that was a perfect answer. You mentioned it too in the briefing you just gave. Finding relationships with other human beings is an incredibly important skill to have. And we talked a little bit about research and how important it is to combat mis and disinformation, but those human relationships are what you really talked about. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. I mean, look, we'll just start with the media. They're super interesting people to begin with, right? And so actually tonight, as I leave out of here, I'm going to a book party. The reason I'm going is because my colleagues will be there. It's a guy who's getting ready to launch his book. He's a journalist, and he's launching his book, and all of his media colleagues will be there. And I work hard on keeping and maintaining those relationships, not because I'm expecting something from it. And I think I always have to say that relationships are non-transactional. It's part of the business, right? We're human beings. We work together. We should have relationships. And so I just gave advice to a young public affairs officer. We going back to Daytona, we were down there, and she was in charge of a group of paratroopers. And I just reminded her, hey, you know, these media folks that we're talking to, maybe they're just local Floridians, or maybe they're specific to NASCAR. Meet them, talk to them, get their phone numbers. You never know when you're gonna, you know, need to reach out to Daytona sometime, and talk to a media contact. So that's on the media side, but there's also plenty of relationships to be built across our joint force. And across our, you know, for me in our Army, I'd like to say I could reach out to almost any post or organization and generally know the public affairs officer or the general in charge of it and be able to get something done, right? So if there's something blowing up on social media about Fort Liberty, is not a good example because I lived there so many years, but I don't know, some other post, NTC or something, I could reach out to somebody and cue them into what's going on if they don't already know, and also get the facts and try to help them maybe put out a fire or maybe throw gasoline on a fire if it's something that we want to take advantage of. And then, of course, across the joint force, it's an investment in people. I don't mean to sound all touchy-feely, but we're human beings, and I think we thrive on knowing each other, and I think an extra 2 or 3 minutes getting to know somebody, knowing their name, and kind of investing in them a little bit goes a long way. Not because we're trying to gain something, just because it's, you know, it's what we do, friend.
Yeah, we care about people.
That's right.
We tell our young public affairs professionals as they're going through their basic training that the most important thing for them, their overall goal, is to communicate the commander's intent. What does that mean to you? How would you best help explain that to them?
Yeah, that's funny. That's a good question because on the way back, we just did a public event yesterday at CSIS. And on the way back, I was with General George just kind of talking about how the event went or whatever. And I mentioned that I was coming over to DINFOS to talk to students. And he doesn't like to do these public events too much. And so I said, What would be your advice for me to carry forward to these students? And he said, know your boss. And he kind of paused and laughed a little bit. He said, some bosses don't like to do a whole bunch of public events. So he was referring to one we just did that I made him do. And he said, no, but seriously, the you have to understand where your boss is at in terms of the public stuff. And so some bosses grew up like mine and Chief Staff of the Army, he's been doing this for 40 years. He hasn't had a whole bunch of interaction with the media. He's had a decent amount, of course, but not like he hasn't been on stage that much and had a whole bunch of those kind of interactions. General Milley, on the other hand, you know, he had been Chief of Staff. He'd been, I think, a 4-star for like 8 years by the time I was working with him. So he'd been the Chief of Staff of the Army, where he was on stage all the time, and then I took over with him after his first year as the chairman. And, you know, he was an old hat. He was very comfortable with the media, very comfortable in front of the camera. And so I'm diverging from your question a little bit in terms of commander's intent, but it's one of the things that that's really important to not only understand your boss's comfort with the media, but his how much he wants to be in the spotlight, how much he needs coaching, how much, you know, does he like positive feedback? Does he like negative feedback? And, you know, this isn't my show. This is his show. So I'm adjusting to him. And I think public affairs officers have to understand that. Certainly, I'm still myself. And you know, he hired me for a reason. He knew who I was. So he hired a certain style of public affairs officer. But I've adjusted to him to make sure that I'm trying to help him and by helping him help the Army as much as I can.
Do you find that as the public affairs officer, your leadership tends to give you your command messages, or do you kind of help them find out what their command messages are from their intent?
Yeah, that's really, really important question. Thanks. I give them what the messages are. And rarely, but sometimes they might say, yeah, I don't know if we should say that. But the reason it starts earlier than me jotting down the messages. General George has been very generous to me and Milley before him and Miller before him. They allow me full access to anything I want to go to, any meeting or whatever, unless it's like a 1v1 meeting with the Secretary of the Army or Secretary of Defense. I can pretty much go to any meeting I want to.
Wow.
And by going to those meetings, I'm picking up the nuggets of the kind of things that we're working on. I'm understanding the technicals of what we're trying to do, and that's the way I generate messages and generate kind of the talking points because I'm informed. I need to tell the other side of the story. That's all internal. Right, I'm seeing all this internal. I'm understanding what we're trying to do, but I'm also the only person in those meetings that's reading the news as deeply as I am, talking to journalists as deeply as I am, understanding our higher headquarters where OSD is and where the NSC is, and so we're meshing together what's going on in the internal meeting to what's going on in the public, putting those together and figuring out the best way to craft a public message. That makes sense?
Yeah, that's excellent. That's the best way I think I've ever heard it explained.
Ooh, so yeah. There you go.
So for our junior personnel who don't have the luxury of attending those meetings, what kind of research should they be doing? Where should they be spending their time to understand the commander's intent and message?
Yeah, so you have to know what your organization does. And I think that easier said than done. But if you're not going to those meetings, you should figure out a way to get there. And again, I want to say that humbly, it's much easier. I've been very, very lucky to have bosses who kind of have taken me along. But if you can't get it from the meetings, and this sounds terrible, we've said meetings 100 times by now. I am a staff officer, I guess. You just have to figure out a way to understand what your organization is doing. And that's getting out of the office. That's talking to people beyond just the public affairs people. You know, if on the Army side, you know, if you're at a division, you've got to understand what the S3 is doing. You've got to understand the broader concept. And again, it doesn't just come from meetings, although that's the easiest way because they're usually back briefing the boss on the bigger picture things. But it's talking to folks within your organization. Yeah. We used to say PAO, and the O stands for operations. And operations doesn't have to be something, you know, abroad. Operations is whatever your organization is doing.
When you worked with General Milley in what was a very tumultuous time and maybe an unexpectedly tumultuous time, and I'm sure there were some unique lessons that you learned there that kind of dealt with your work and how it was sort of maybe not the normal public affairs experience. Can you kind of speak to that and what lessons you learned that might be helpful to the career field?
Yeah, man, it was a wild time. I mean, I remember January 6th very specifically, and there are some times that really are seared into my mind about, you know, what went on in those couple of years. In terms of lessons, I'm going to say two opposing things. I'm going to say don't sweat the small stuff, and sometimes you have to sweat the small stuff. And so, this was a time, you'll remember, your audience may or may not remember, you know, the military was getting attacked, really, by not only our adversaries, but also internally by members of our government and others. You know, we had the whole woke narrative. We had, General Milley followed President Trump through Lafayette Square, so he considered resigning for that, and he publicly apologized. And so you can imagine the amount of social media vitriol that was happening and the hate that was coming out, unfortunately. And, you know, I know the guy, you know. He's certainly meant no harm by any of this, and he certainly accepted responsibility for a lot of it. And so, on one hand, you could really get derailed on paying attention to the editorial side of Fox News or to the really nasty social media. You could get totally distracted, totally derailed, and it could actually affect your consciousness, right? It gives you a bad day. And that could be a bad day over the course of several weeks and months. And that's no way to live. But we have a job. We have a mission. So at the same time, I say don't sweat the small stuff, and you got to focus on the mission and focus on what our real job is. And from the Joint Staff, you know, that's a pretty important job, advising the president on best how to defend this country. At the same time, though, you do have to understand what the heck is going on out there. And this is not a partisan comment, but, you know, I had to watch Tucker Carlson, and I didn't really want to. I had to watch him, you know, rip on the woke military. I'm putting my fingers up in air quotes, because I know we're not woke, right? But I had to also have a good understanding of what was out there, because it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. There's what we're actually doing in our operational mission, but then there's all the public stuff that we that affects what we're doing. It affects you know, how our nation supports us. It affects how our adversaries approach us. And so it was, that was a difficult time. I didn't really give you any good lessons, but.
It was a good steer to hear, though. I mean, yeah. Honestly, I think the biggest takeaway that I got from that time and from your story and from what I've heard you talk about that time was how important it is to understand what you're doing in the digital space, because the informational digital space is so large and has so many eyes on it. Can you kind of speak to what you think are the best practices for operating in that digital space?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I think that we're a little wayward as a military on the digital space. I think there's a lot of, really trying hard to just blankly tell good news stories or, put stuff out there without necessarily thinking of the audience or the purpose. And this is it's a good example to talk about this because during that time, and I want to acknowledge that's lessened quite a bit, right? People aren't going at the military so hard anymore, although I think there's been some trust lost. During that time, you know, if you put out a picture of a guy carrying a rifle, people would start commenting negatively on it, and it was kind of a wild thing where you could almost do nothing on social media without it turning back on you and becoming a problem. But we kept doing it. We just kept pushing stuff out, and we were recognizing, every month of the year is a new recognition month, and we were putting that out, and it was getting into the mass media. And I would just say that we got to figure out what our purpose is, what our organization's purpose is, and communicate in that way to enhance the purpose of that organization. And I'm going to say purpose 11 more times, because every word that comes out of our mouth, every tweet or every picture that we send out, every talking point I write for the boss has a purpose intended, right? It's got something that we want to inform a particular audience, or we need to, you know, we're trying to influence a certain decision, or we're trying to recognize, you know, a group that we need to recognize for a specific purpose. It's not about clicks, and it's not about how much you can get out there. It's about communicating for purpose every single time, because all communication is risk, and I'm not a risk-averse fellow. I don't mean it like that. I'll communicate my butt off, as you can see what I'm doing here. All communication is risk. So if you're going to take the risk, which you should, then you do it with purpose. That makes sense?
Absolutely. I think you're 100% right. When you communicate with purpose to a particular audience, then you're doing the best possible job, right? We have too many shotgun blasts of communication where we need to be more scalpel focused, I think, to get the information out there to the proper people. When I was listening into the conversation that you just had, a lot of public affairs officers were having conversations about what our role is as it pertains to misinformation and disinformation. Can you talk about your experiences and your thoughts with that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. The old school of thought, maybe the one I grew up on, is don't go after mis or disinformation because you'll just give it a bigger platform. And if you ignore it, it will likely go away. Not really the case these days, but it's a judgment call. And so, man, I'm trying to think. The White House actually just went through this. I can't remember the example now, but General Miller texted me about it because we had dealt with it so much in Afghanistan. And he texted me. He said, "Man, they should have gotten on this faster," which he was right. But nowadays, you really got to make a difficult judgment call. It's too simple to say, don't address it, because you'll be given a better platform. You'll be given it legitimacy, is what we used to say. And I certainly hear that side of the argument. I mean, there is merit to that side of the argument. Like, for instance, if you have adversary like the Taliban or ISIS or something, and you pick up on a social media post that they did, and you know, you call out the bad things about it or that it's BS, you're certainly platforming that person, right? But at the same time, these things go viral pretty quick, and they get picked up in the mass media pretty quick. And so you have to make a fairly quick judgment call to be able to address it. If you can build a mechanism, and we're trying to build this in the Army right now, where you have communicators who are watching the social media environment and understand the operational environment, like we'll put them in the basement of the Pentagon, right, where everything is actually happening down there, and we've empowered them with the ability to combat mis or disinformation. They don't have to ask Mother May I to 15 people, then you can rapidly address things without platforming it and without allowing it to go viral. So like a lame kind of garrison example might be when somebody shares a picture of mold in the barracks. We have barracks issues that we're trying to fix right now in the Army, I think across the military, really. And we're working really hard to fix it with some really, really unique solutions. I'm not going to be able to argue that on social media. But if the picture of the barracks with mold was from 2008, anybody that's empowered to speak publicly could say, hey, that's an old picture. We're working really hard to fix the barracks. It's not going to really win you any favors, but it might knock down the a viral photo of, like, you know, a terrible photo of a barracks or whatever. And, you know, a lot of these images and videos and stuff right now, and it'll get worse and worse as technology develops, are easy enough to locate fakes or old. You know, a reverse Google search will tell you where a photo came from. And so I think there's a technique we need to build in empowered communicators that can act rapidly to combat mis and disinformation. You know, I told the story of the Taliban on another podcast I did, which was we just started doing that like wild in Afghanistan, and
it was communicating fun. Via social media, you mean?
Yeah. Luckily, I inherited like a pretty large Twitter account, so it used to be just kind of like the spokesperson account. So we did it by name to give it some legitimacy, and when we got there in 2018, probably the Taliban owned the media. They not only said whatever they wanted on social media, but the local media in Afghanistan were taking what they said as fact and reporting it. And we just started saying, when they said stuff that wasn't true, we just started saying, this is false. This is not true. I would like literally say false and tweet at Zabahullah or whatever. And it was interesting because, you know, sometimes they would fight back and forth with us, but they were forced to try to prove what they were saying. And then further, it got picked up like on the local news. Like, you know, I don't speak Pashto, but I'm looking up at the TV screen and I see my picture up there with the tweets. And it's like U.S. spokesman battles with the Taliban on Twitter. And I'm like, oh, this is, you know, this is kind of strange. But it took away their complete freedom of maneuver that they had. And then, you know, of course, the next step was trying to empower the Afghans to do it. But anyway, that's just a silly story. And let's recognize that was back in 2018. And man, how much has stuff advanced now in 2024? It's wild. One more Afghan story?
Oh, please.
So, talk about mis and disinformation. He wasn't really Taliban, but kind of an insider attack killed Afghan police chief General Razik right next to General Miller. The guy was standing right next to General Miller. Shot him in Kandahar. And, you know, I was there, and the first thing that I thought after I put my weapon away was, I got to get to the Pentagon to communicate with the Pentagon and explain to them that, yes, the four-star was just involved in a firefight, but he's fine. The chain of command is intact and everything's okay. We're moving on with the mission. So I'm thinking U.S. media, right? Which was... you know, I honestly got right on the phone with Barbara Starr. I called her like from the place. And so I was trying to make sure that the Pentagon, DC, American narrative was on track with the truth. What I wasn't looking at, what was going on in Afghanistan, and a New York Times journalist who was Afghan called me probably 2 days after the attack and said, "Hey, man, do you know that almost everybody I talk to in Afghanistan believes that General Miller killed General Razik?" And I was like, "What are you talking about? That's silly." You know, I'm a member of the old school where I'm like, I'm not going to address this mis and disinformation. That's, you know, that's crazy. Who would believe that?
Turns out.
Well, like the whole country.
Sure.
That's who would believe that. And so we had insider attacks based on that, like some Afghans who we thought were friends of ours thought we killed Razik and were like coming after us.
Wow.
It was wild. And so that was a wake-up call for me about the, you know, I actually luckily went to War College after that, and I was able to do a bunch of research, and I wrote a paper on how these kind of things pick up. It was crazy. People believed in all their heart
Yeah, and the immediacy of it too. It's not just necessarily the beliefs that it can generate, but how fast it can do it as well.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You talked about empowering your people to make those decisions accurately and quickly. How important of the two of those do you think accuracy is?
Oh man, yeah, I've gotten this question before, and it's challenging. If I'm gonna give advice to public affairs people like I'm trying to do now, I would say be fast, because if you can't be fast, you can't be right. The default usually in our military is to be right, and so it takes a long time. And we just talked through that example, but there's so many more examples that, and especially, to be honest, working on the Army staff, some of these issues are really, really technical and complicated. And you end up staffing it through, 27 people. And then, everybody's adding their opinion, too. It's not just staffing the facts. And you come out the other end with some gobbledygook that is not useful for the public. It's not useful for the media. And it's not useful to combat misinformation or even inform what's going on. So if you can't be fast, then you won't be right. And if you're not fast, you can't be right. So I would err on the side of speed. And I just want to get to another thing that you said. You got to be able to trust people. And people are going to make mistakes. I certainly do. And I say dumb stuff all the time. A lot of times, no. Sometimes I say stuff that's not factual because, I have my facts wrong or whatever. Not purposely evading anybody. And one, because I have relationships with the media, I can usually clean that up. But two, if I make a mistake, my boss trusts me. He knows what I was trying to do. And we really, really have to be good in the public affairs community to empower young public affairs officers to go after it. Yeah, sure, you can talk to the media. Go talk to the media. Yeah, maybe you could do it off the record first and try it out a little bit. But then if you have to go on the record, I trust you to go on the record. And if you screw it up, I'll underwrite your risk. I'll take responsibility for it. We have to get better at that as a profession, or else we'll never be good.
Just empowering our service members and our public affairs professionals to do the job accurately.
That's it.
What's the biggest difference, and I guess what are some of the similarities between trying to craft policy at a military level and then again at a command level as it pertains to public affairs officers?
I think the similarities are you usually just have a basic set of facts, which is nice. People think that that it's super complicated the higher you go. And I did just say the Army is complicated, but for a different reason. But usually, if you start with the facts, then you can figure everything else out. And, this is something that we learned at JSOC early on was you get the 5 W's together. You get what actually happened. And then you figure out what to say. Oftentimes in public affairs world and really command world, when you're thinking about public stuff, you start saying, this is what we should say without figuring out actually, what the facts are. So I think the difficulty, the higher you go, is there's a lot more equities. So, on the joint staff, before we said something, I certainly had to coordinate with state, with OSD. A lot of times it's international, so with that, whatever that host country was, with the NSC, so the National Security Council of the White House. There's a lot of different kind of dogs at the party, you know what I mean? And so you have to kind of understand who's where on what and make sure you're keeping everybody well-informed to communicate. And you got to, back to our point from before, you got to do that rapidly. There's not a whole bunch of time to waste usually when you're doing this stuff.
I feel like I could ask you 100 different questions about your time at JSOC as obviously that's a super interesting place to be.
Yeah, it was.
Do you have any fun stories from there? Anything that you think our service members or our listeners would appreciate knowing? You could tell anyway.
We had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun. We had a fish tank in our office, so that was fun. but I could tell you some probably not so fun stories. I remember we just did a big operation, and I had called my good friend who was the deputy there, civilian deputy. And I said, "Hey, man, I can't tell you what's going on, but you need to come in," and because we're in the middle of some stuff. And he was pretty mad. Like, I think he was on a date with his wife or whatever. And so, and he lived like an hour away. So he came in, man. He was cursing and like he was like, "What the? Why'd you call me in? Do you really? You know? Do I need to?" And he looked up at the screen, and he saw like all the mayhem that was going on. And he sat down and he started typing out public affairs guidance. And I just remember those times that you know, you're at the edge at JSOC. You're at the edge of kind of what our nation is doing a lot of times. And they're going to find out super fast, as secretive as we are and as close hold as we try to keep everything. Once shots are fired, you know, we're going to be in the media, and you got to be a little bit ahead of that. I always remember leaving, you know, we'd do the operation through the night on the East Coast, and I'd be leaving the compound, and the first person I would call usually was Captain Jeff Davis, who was the DOD press operations guy at the time. And I'll just say, "Hey, in about an hour, you're going to have a line outside your office. I'm going to sleep. So here's what you need to know." And, you know, public affairs is great because we're so much faster than operations, right? The J3s and the S3s talk to each other in kind of a formatted way. They have meetings. They're sending emails and stuff. I'm picking up the phone from a three-star command and calling basically the Office of Secretary of Defense and filling the guy in on my cell phone on what he needs to know to talk to the American public. Or, you know, in some cases, I'm talking to the media myself. And it's great because we do this across the world. Like, I always try to explain to people, I don't need the J3's permission to talk to a fellow public affairs officer. And so you show up to your morning meeting, say you're at Northcom or something or a brigade, but you happen to know a public affairs officer that works in the Pentagon, maybe they work at DOD. And you can ask a guy or girl what's going on. And you show up to your morning meeting and your boss is like, "All right, what's going on in the news, Billy?" And, you know, Billy reads back what he just talked to his friend at the Pentagon about. And he's like, "What the, you know, you just gave me a picture of what the national media is doing and what the Secretary of Defense is doing today." And I don't know if it's useful or not, but point is, we can talk across every echelon. There's no, the public affairs communication is flat. So it's really cool like that.
100%. Yeah, I agree with you. As you look forward, what do you think the future of information warfare looks like?
Fast. I think it's fast.
Thanks to the digital space?
Yeah, the amount of people that are operating in it, certainly to the digital space. It's interesting. Like I told the class, I pay a lot of attention to industry news, right? And if you look at the, you know, we put a lot of stock in CNN and Fox News and MSNBC. If you look at their viewership, you know, they're down in the dumps, right? So people aren't watching cable news like we think they are. Fewer and fewer people are watching network news, although still a lot of people watch network news. Not that many people are really on X and really on Instagram, although, you know, it's still a lot. So I think we've got to figure out a way still to operate in the information space, but casting aside our old you know, our old assumptions on the best venues to do that. And this is not new to say, but communication has to be organic and it has to be humanized. Still, I think as we sit here today, the best venue to communicate to the American people is probably the traditional media, but that's changing rapidly. And we're going to have to figure out a way still to communicate to the American people. It's not, this is newsflash, it's not like stand-up videos that you have your boss reading from a teleprompter from or reading from a card. Hello, I'm Colonel Dave Butler, and I'm here to tell you Merry Christmas or whatever it is.
We love those.
No, we don't. Maybe we do. But those don't get anywhere, and they don't do anything for anybody.
Right. Again, purposeful communication, as you said.
Purposeful communication specific to your audience. You got it, man.
What is the number one piece of advice that you would give to new public affairs personnel coming in?
It's easier said than done. I think you really got to become an expert in your task. You got to read. You got to read both. About your craft, about media and public affairs. You got to read about, you know, what your organization is doing, if it's the Army or your specific organization. And you've got to read the news. It's, you know, the clips every day. You have to read the news that's right around your locality. You have to read, if you're a Navy public affairs officer, you should be reading about how boats are made, ships they call them. But you should understand all aspects of the media, because your organization, a lot of times only you, depends on just you to be that expert. You know what I mean? Nobody wants you to show up unprepared. And the way you prepare is by understanding your environment, reading news, reading about your industry, reading about your task. So that's my advice, friend.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to add, sir, that we didn't get to, or anything we didn't talk about you want to share with our audience?
No, I appreciate you guys. For your audience, I just, you know, it's really unique and really cool thing to do anything in public affairs. And I'm not just a sycophant because I've been doing it for a little while. I see myself next to my peers, and I see my non-commissioned officers next to their peers. And what public affairs folks get to do is really, really unique and amazing, really. It's no offense to any other job in the military, but our job is actually pretty cool.
It's the best.
It really is. And I don't mean just say that because we're on the DINFOS thing. I tell everybody that. I mean, we're entrusted to do a lot. It's really, really cool. So, good luck to those folks because they're going to have fun.
It's the best job in the world. That's what I keep telling them. They're going to have a great time. They don't even know yet.
They don't even know yet. So it's good.
Sir, thank you so much for joining us. I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I really appreciate you coming on, and I cannot wait to have you back on. If you'll agree, we're certainly going to have you on time and again, because I think as the information space changes, we could use some more information from you.
Yeah,
thank you so much, sir. Appreciate you.
Take care.